My next guest and I have something in common. We have both played in the $10,000 buy-in main event of the World Series of Poker. Neither of us put up $10,000 of our own money. I got in through a qualifying tournament here in St. Louis. He got his buy-in paid for by Grantland Magazine. And now he's written a story about it that has, well, first appeared on Grantland and then was expanded into a full book called The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. Colson Whitehead, welcome to the Big 550.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on here. What was your deal with Grantland and their parent company, ESPN, if you did finish in the money and take home something, not winning it, not even making the final table, but if you made back any kind of money, did they get a piece of it?
No, I mean, people always ask if I won anything, would I be able to keep it? If I won like $8 million, they might be a little upset. But, you know, my fee for the article was the entrance fee, so I didn't make any money on writing it. And if you look at it cynically, Grantland's owned by ESPN, ESPN's owned by Disney, and they own the TV rights to the World Series of Poker. So each time you write about the World Series of Poker for an ESPN magazine, you're basically doing an advertisement for ESPN. So I guess I would have been glad if I'd made something, but I didn't.
So they considered it part of the marketing for them, and you considered it part of something that you could turn into a book and sell a bunch of copies of, and it did well in hardcover, and now it's just come out in paperback this month. Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Let's talk
about it. I'm not sure if they saw it as an advertisement, but I think, you know, in today's corporate culture, anything you do is an advertisement because somebody probably owns what you're writing about. But
you are not the first writer to do this, to take the fee for your services and turn them into a buy-in for the WSOP. A guy by the name of Jim McManus did this more than a decade ago and wrote a terrific book about his experience there. But yours is different because it took place during the poker boom back in 2011, right before the bottom fell out because online poker became illegal in the United States. So you probably read McManus's book. How was your experience different from his?
Oh yeah, I mean, he's a really good player. You know, he made it to the final table and made some money. I'm really a home player. You know, my monthly game is $5 buy-in, and you know, a big night of winning is winning like $15. So I think, you know, when you're a writer, you know, you're always doing what other people have done before, whether it's a war story, a romance, or a discussion of middle American dissatisfaction in the suburbs. And all you can do is bring your own sort of writerly personality, your own sort of unique characteristics to this new topic. So for me, it's really about just, you know, someone having no skills, having 3 months to cram and get up to tournament level play. And so I would take trips to Atlantic City and do as many tournaments as I can and come back to New York and take my child to school and try to live my own life while at night becoming this, you know, baby gambler.
You also got a coach, a woman by the name of Helen, right?
Yeah, it seemed to make sense to get a coach, you know, in terms of, you know, being Rocky and needing Burgess Meredith in your corner. So there's a woman named Helen Ellis, who's a novelist. I only meet writers, really. So who's been stepping up her presence on the circuit lately, the last couple of years, and had played in some of the run-up games to the main event of the World Series of Poker. And so she took me under her wing and, you know, told me which books to read. I was reading all the wrong books. And so she told me to read, you know, Dan Harrington, Phil Gordon, stuff like that, and told me where to play in Atlantic City. And was just, you know, really helpful in taking, you know, this very unskilled person, me, and teaching them just, you know, the sort of baby steps on how to play tournament poker.
All right, now this brings me to a semi-sensitive question, which is that the World Series of Poker, women are way in the minority, particularly in the main event. I think it's somewhere around 3.5% of the thousands of people who are playing in the main event are women. And only slightly more than that are African-American. Here you are, an African-American guy, coached by a woman against a sea of white guys, mostly really, really young.
Surely. Yeah, I mean, I think that they're young, but also, you know, I think people who can afford the $10,000 buy-in, you know, a lot of middle-aged guys who have been saving up, you know, for years, have always wanted to go, and they're in a room. I think, you know, I mean, I definitely stuck out, you know, in the picture. I would not be a typical player at the table. But once you're sitting down there, it's all about the signs of play. And, you know, you're playing your opponents, no matter what they look like or where they come from, you're just trying to win. And so I always felt, like, once I felt acclimated to the culture, I didn't feel that much of an outsider when I usually do as a writer. And I think everyone who's playing is sort of acting as an observer, you know, stepping apart, but also in the action. So I think, you know, being a writer is probably a good training for playing the World Series of Poker, because you're observing your opponents and taking notes, but also participating. So you're outside and inside at the same time.
And because everybody has to observe not only the play and the cards, but the players and how they look and how they act, and frankly, you have to profile people at the table. What,
sure.
What did Helen tell you about your image when she first met you?
Well, I mean, I like clothes. You know, I'm a bit of a dandy, and she said that I'd be targeted because I don't fit in. I don't fit at the table, and then additionally because I kept making mistakes. You know, I'm a sort of a nervous guy, and some people work on their tell, some people work on their table presence. I worked on not keeping my hands from shaking, you know, too much at the table, and having huge sweat marks. So dreadlocks and my little, you know, sort of dandy clothes stuck out. But I think if I was, you know, a super aggressive player, they'd be watching my cards, not my face.
Yeah. Did you find, even before you went to the Rio in Las Vegas to play in the World Series of Poker, that when you went to Atlantic City and played in some of the dumps there, that the people at that level were profiling you? Or was that so completely different, there's no comparison?
It is so different. I mean, you know, when you're playing, you know, you have a maximum of $100 you want to spend each night, and then versus 10,000, you know, or plus the shame of telling everybody you left your work and your job for a week to go to Las Vegas. I mean, I think the scale is so much different. So, you know, you are always profiling people at the table, and then after that, it's how they're playing actually, and not what they look like.
So,
not that poker is, you know, this super melting pot, but you know, play eventually is more important than a personal appearance.
But personal appearance is a factor again, and I'm curious about what you wore.
Sure. Well, you know, I was having a bit fun with, you know, how to be myself at the World Series of Poker, and it seemed that it's a World Series of Poker, but what country do I actually represent? And so I came up with the idea that I'm a representative of the Republic of Anhedonia. Anhedonia being a psychological term for the inability to feel pleasure. So I sort of have a depressive personality, and the Republic of Anhedonia is my true homeland. So so I got a sweatshirt with the Republic of Anhedonia stitched into it, just so people would know where I was coming from. When I was training, I didn't think that I would wear sunglasses. It seemed kind of jerky. But when I first walked into the Rio, where they hold the World Series, I was coming in from outside, and I was wearing my sunglasses, and I did feel actually much comfortable wearing sunglasses. So I wore my prescription sunglasses, and yeah, that was my little armor at the table, and I think it helped a little bit.
When you walk in there, it's a sea of people. And by the way, just a little trivia note, Anhedonia was the original name for Woody Allen's movie Annie Hall, because that was the characteristic of his character, unable to enjoy anything.
I think the word appeals to like urban sort of neurotics like myself and other you know comedians. So
when you do go walk in there, you see this sea of people, many of them, as I mentioned, 20-somethings who are wearing hoodies and some of them sunglasses, lots of hats, lots of people wearing headphones. But you also hear this sound, and I'm curious if the first time you walked in there, and I've been to the WSOP many, many times, what were the first time you walked in there, did you notice the sound?
Sure. I mean, it's just a chip is just a tiny plastic disc, but then you multiply it by 200 tables in one room and 10 players at each table, and people are fidgeting, people are throwing chips in, dealers are, you know, throwing chips around, and you get this, you know, symphony of crickets, and that's what it sounds like. This is click, clack, clack, click, 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 clack, from thousands of people just worrying their chips in this room. And the room is, you know, as big as an airplane hangar. And it's full of people who are desperate, people who are winning, people who just want to, you know, just fighting their way into the final table, round by round and hand by hand. And the dominant sound is the sound of the crickets the chips clicking against each other.
Absolutely. Can't hear it anyplace else but in a giant poker tournament like that.
Sure, surely.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Colson Whitehead, whose book, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, is now out in paperback. You mentioned that you were used to playing in $5 home games with a bunch of other writers. At that level, poker is much more social. You know, people end up staying in to see the river card, even if they have no chance at all, just because, well, you know what, I'm going to stay in here because Tony played a hand against me, I'm going to play a hand against him. Very, very different when you're playing at the tournament level, and certainly at the WSOP main event level, isn't it?
Oh, of course. I mean, you're getting out once a month, you're seeing your friends, and you're not paying attention. You're talking about how your roof needs to be repaired, or little Jimmy is not testing well in school, and you know, you're just catching up with your friends, and it's not such a big deal to reach into your pocket and pull out 50 cents to match like the final bet if you want to stay in on the river.
Yeah.
And so when I took the assignment, I mean, I was not aware of tournament rules and how you pace yourself, and you know, the different phases of levels, and basically all the betting conventions are so different from your casual play. So that's you know, why I went to Atlantic City as many times as I could before going to Las Vegas. Just because it's a different culture and a different style of play. There's an ebb and flow when you should be aggressive or more aggressive and then more aggressive, and when you can relax a little bit. And so all those codes are so, you know, they're sort of beautiful and intricate. And learning the language of higher level poker was, you know, such a rewarding experience, even if I forgot most of the rules.
Were you making mistakes there, like betting out of turn?
In tournaments, I got that out of my system, and then once I got to the World Series, I was so nervous that, yes, I would bet out of turn, or I'd bet under the minimum bet. But each time, over the days I was playing, I only made those mistakes like once. Like, I sort of got them out of my system, and each level I got more in tune with what I'd learned and the rules of the World Series. And so it sounds sad, but, you know, for 10 minutes before I went out, I was playing, like, really top-notch poker, like the best poker I've ever played or ever will play.
And how's your game been since then?
Well, you know, I mean, once you fly so high, it's hard to come back to earth. And so for the first 2 years, whenever I played my home game, this bell would go off my head, and I'd think, I really have to go to Atlantic City. I have to go to Atlantic City. Like, I can't, I can't play these low stakes or these mellow stakes. And now, 3 years later, just my lifestyle doesn't allow me to go to Atlantic City as much or Foxwoods or local casinos. So I am sort of back to earth, and I appreciate my mellow game for what it is, a chance to see my friends. You know, we're all pretty busy, and, you know, I'm losing $3. But I'm catching up with everybody.
Yeah. You know, I asked you about how you were profiled and what Helen told you about how you would be profiled at the table. But you also write extensively in the book about the people you were playing against, not just at the WSOP, but also in the smaller tournaments that you played in Atlantic City. Now, St. Louis has a pretty good poker culture here. We've got several casinos that have poker rooms in them. I'm a regular in one of them myself, which is why I was fascinated in reading your book, which I scarfed up, by the way, in a weekend. It was a great read.
Thank you.
I'm curious if you could share some of your observations about other players with my audience.
Sure. I mean, there's a sort of middle-aged white guy with a big metal watch on his hand, who I would call the Big Mitch, and he's there for the weekend. He wants a big hand that he can, you know, share with his, you know, tell about to his buddies on Monday when he goes back to work. And he's really just, you know, spending some disposable income. He's distracted by, you know, things at home, the new boiler, is his daughter having a party while they're out of town, and, you know, and that kind of 40-something, 50-something guy makes up a lot of the, you know, I think, casino players. There's Messy Mike, my name for that kind of harrowed local character. I'm not sure how it is in St. Louis, but Atlantic City, you get a lot of sort of local guys who look like Iggy Pop on a bad day. And they sort of know all the cocktail waitresses' names and the dealers' names. And they always, like, share some hard luck story about why they haven't been to the tables for a month, or, you know, a pair of jacks that ruined them 20 years ago. Like, you know, get over it. It was 20 years ago.
They remember every bad beat story from their entire life, and they do not hesitate to share it with you, do they?
Yes, bad beats at the table and off the table. You know, that's all there for easy recall.
Yep.
And then you're talking about the young players, the Robotrons, as I call them, and they have the earbuds in, they're listening to, like, self-help books or death metal, and they're wearing hoodies, and, you know, and they were raised on the modern poker culture of, you know, televised poker, the online sites when they were operating. You know, they learned how to play by playing 8 screens at once. And then once they were shut down, the online sites, they came to the casinos. And so they're there, you know, with their, you know, vibrating with aggression, with their sunglasses and their earbuds. And you're right, they make up a lot of the players now. They're 20 to 21, 22, and they've been raised in this sort of hothouse of poker.
You have the words beef jerky in the title of your book. That's because the World Series of Poker is sponsored by a beef jerky company, which, as far as I'm concerned, tells everyone else in the world, don't respect our game.
Surely. Yes, because, you know, the first thing you see when when you're watching televised poker, the first commercial is always, one of those Sasquatch commercials.
Yes.
For beef jerky, and it takes the tone down a bit.
Yeah, there's no Apple, there's no Pepsi, there's no Chevrolet. It's depressing to me that we can't find big corporate America to find out, you know what, this is a room with 8,000 people in it, all of whom might want to buy your services, not to mention those who are watching it on ESPN or whatever channel other poker programming is on.
Yeah, I think they have to work on that on that one, on some of the branding a little bit.
The book is called The Noble Hustle: Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. It is now out in paperback, and as I said, it is a great read. Even if you're not a poker player, I think you'll enjoy the way Colson writes. He's written several best-selling novels before this one, and would you ever go back and play in the main event?
If someone else paid for me, yeah, $10,000 is a big sort of bite. It really was, you know, such a lovely experience, and even just to be in town at the same time and watch it and play a satellite game would be fun.
Yeah, I think every poker player should go out to the WSOP at some point in their life just to see and hear what you experienced. And like you, I'm only going back into the main event when someone else pays the way.
Surely,
Colson, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.